snapped. Put that knife through her temple now. No, Jacob said. You can't. They looked at him, above and below, taken aback by the tone of his voice.
Is that so? I suppose we can't kill the infidels at the pass, either. And yet we have.
You're the last.
Pray tell me, beast, why we should spare a heretic. The only thing in this world worse than the Horde.
Because your leaders will demand to question the prophesied one.
The one above spoke. And what would an animal know about a prophesied one?
There is no such thing.
These are lies spun by those who undermine Elion's holy ways.
I am Jacob, son of Kurong, and the girl you wish to kill is the 49th mystic.
Kurong's son?
His voice was filled with doubt. Yes.
Then all the more reason you will die.
I'm only telling you so you don't give your commanders reason to take your heads.
If it's true, the one above said, they'll want to torture them for the information. There will be gold for these.
The warrior on the ground considered his companion's opinion, then walked up to the woman and shoved the heel of his boot into her wound. She groaned, but didn't wake. The man spat to one side.
Filthy heretic. She's already half dead.
No, Jacob said. She's only sleeping.
I say we kill them both now. They stink of trouble.
Hold! Jacob glanced up and saw that a sixth warrior had appeared, this one with a golden armband that differentiated him from the others. The warrior nearby dipped his head in respect.
Sire.
The leader dropped to the ground with the grace of a bird of prey. He pulled down the black cloth that covered his face, exposing a jaw chiseled from stone and deep eyes that knew no fear. He glanced at the 49th, then leveled his gaze at Jacob.
I am Aaron, son of Mossium, commander of the Elionite elite.
You are Jacob, son of Kurong, you say.
I am.
And you claim this woman is the 49th mystic.
Can you think of any other reason the son of Kurong would find himself so far from his own women? She is no ordinary albino, I can assure you.
The son of Mossium studied him for a long moment. He struck Jacob as a man given to few words, confident in his authority and power. From what Jacob had seen on this mountain tonight, the Elionites more than lived up to the rumors of their fighting prowess. Not that Jacob feared the man. He feared none. Perhaps they would one day test each other on neutral ground. Then he would know what the man was really made of. Aaron dipped his head.
Consider this woman to have extended your life, son of Kurong, though I think you will regret it.
He spoke to his men without removing his eyes from Jacob.
Bind them.
Chapter 21. I was dreaming, and in that dream, Barth beat my father and shot me. The bullet broke my thigh bone. They dragged me to a cellar, dumped me in a cell, and left me in that dank darkness to contend with throbbing pain. The pain kept me awake for a long time before sleep mercifully put me out of my misery. That was my dream. And it slowly faded as I returned to consciousness in the real world, the one in which Talia and I had climbed to the pass of the Great Divide, found a small enclave among boulders, and cooked some old corn over a small fire before climbing under blankets to sleep. Talia had kissed my hand before retiring.
"No matter what happens tomorrow," he said, "remember that every encounter is an opportunity for salvation from the storm. What you are tempted to call a problem is only an instrument for awakening, so that you can see what is true, as seen in Christie. As such, it is your gift. Promise me you will remember this.
I was still floating from my experience on the cliff. There I had seen why Yeshua slept through the storm on the sea and asked those with him why they were afraid. There was no reason to be. I had just seen what he had seen, so I wasn't concerned about any coming problems.
I promise, I said.
I'd fallen asleep in the safe place with a smile on my face. The rocking beneath me pulled me quickly from sleep, and I opened my eyes.
Light, bright light.
We were moving.
I jerked up. Talia?
Pain shot up my leg and I cried out, grasping at my thigh. Someone had tied a strip of cloth around the wound. The cloth was red with blood.
Easy. Easy. Don't move.
A hand rested on my shoulder, and I turned, expecting to see Talia. Instead, I saw what first appeared to be a monster of sorts, with flaking gray skin and long matted dreadlocks. Horde. I recoiled, confused and terrified. The wound on my thigh. Barth had shot me in my dreams.
Where's Talia?
You're badly wounded. Please try not to move. I did my best to clean and wrap it, but my experience doesn't extend beyond battle dressing. With any luck, these barbarians will have physicians to ease the pain and set your leg. Until then, moving will only cause your bones to grind. Quite painful.
I twisted, searching for Talia. We were in a small horse-drawn cage with filthy straw on the floor. A bald albino sat in the corner, back to me. We were passing a small wooden house with a green lawn. Ditches lined either side of the dirt road. 12 or 14 warriors dressed from head to foot in black rode tall stallions in two columns, one on each side of us.
Where are we?
Approaching Mossium, he said. Capital of the Elianites.
Slowly, my predicament came into some clarity. Talia had said I would be alone. In no scenario had I imagined I would find myself a captive with a shattered leg. A young boy was running along the far ditch, jumping up and down, hooting and hollering at the warriors, who paid him no mind. His white tunic was clean, and he wore a bandana, green to match his bright eyes.
We've met, the scab said. Twice. Do you remember?
I looked at him again.
Jacob?
He lowered his head.
At your service.
You were pursuing us, intent on killing me.
Not true, he said, lifting a finger. I was to return you to your rightful place in Baal's dungeons.
My rightful place is nowhere near the Horde.
And yet here you are. I suppose your rightful place is among the Elianites. They certainly don't think so. If not for me, you would be dead.
If not for you?
Indeed. I told them you were the 49th. So now we find ourselves here, on a delightful ride to their city. A beast, that would be me. A heretic, that would be you. And a mute, that would be him.
The bald man in the corner turned his head and studied me for a moment before returning to stare through the bars.
I can't get a word out of him, Jacob said, leaning back against the cage with legs folded, chewing on a piece of straw.
Your men?
I asked him.
Surely you weren't alone.
Darkness settled over his face.
We were nearly 100. The Elianite warriors, 20. I alone survived.
Mako.
He stopped. Mako. While trapped under the cliff, I'd heard him call one of his men that. By his reaction now, I could see they'd been close.
I'm sorry,
I said. He was to be a father this week. If I survive, I will see the child wants for nothing.
I didn't know what to do with his comment, how only 20 of the Elianites had bested 100 of his men. I couldn't imagine. I'd seen Jacob snatch my blade from the air as if it were a toy. What did that say about the Elianite warriors? And what did the remorse written on Jacob's face say about the horde? My leg was throbbing, and I tried to ease the pain by shifting. But each movement only increased it. Seeing my struggle, Jacob shifted and tapped his knee.
If you elevate it, the pain will ease.
He was dressed in a thick dark shirt, with an open neck and canvas pants, tucked into leather boots that hugged his calves. I was dressed in only a long tunic, and my leg was bare. The thought of my skin touching his diseased flesh repulsed me. But his slacks were only cloth, right? I slowly pushed myself up against the adjacent bars and let him take my exposed ankle, lift my leg, and rest my heel on his knee. The brief contact of his hand on my ankle felt like any human touch. Either way, Talia had said, the horde disease wasn't contagious.
Better? He asked.
Not really. No. He watched me curiously.
Give it some time.
Two men drove the cart, laughing at something funny that didn't concern us. Beyond our prison, houses rose among wide crop fields and orchards. Corn, wheat, apples, and several other fruit trees. There was no sign of a city, only these rural plots of land. I was in a strange land without Samuel or Talia, on a mission that now seemed not only impossibly distant, but absurd. Behind the cart, elite warriors rode in aloof supremacy. Inside the cart, the son of Kurong and a silent, bald man left me alone with my thoughts, which gave me neither guidance nor comfort. Alone, and now captive in both realities. What happened? I asked after a long silence. At the pass.
I've been asking myself the same question,
Jacob said, looking at my leg.
Your wound. It just materialized before my eyes.
While I was dreaming. But I hardly understood how such manifestations could cross between realities. And I had no idea how to make him understand. I was shot in another world, and it manifested here. But don't ask me how, because it won't make sense.
Another world?
Like I said, it won't make much sense.
Try me.
I wasn't even sure where to begin. First, tell me how you found us, I said.
Us? We only found you.
Then tell me that.
After a moment, he told me his story, beginning with their pursuit leading up to the Great Divide, how our pace seemed to match theirs, slow or quick. My guide was toying with them. I told him that my guide was no guide, but a mystic named Talia. And if Talia had wanted to, he could have single-handedly wiped them all out.
And yet he left you when you needed him most.
No.
No?
Jacob scoffed.
He fled.
The man who toyed with you for 7 days fled? The one who stilled the storm only last night? The one who sees no threat from any horde, any Elianite, any albino, just up and fled at the first sight of danger? You don't know, Talia. He told me he was leaving.
You're saying the storm that came and went so quickly was his doing?
Yes. He was teaching me to find peace rather than fear in the storm.
So he conjures a storm to teach the priestess a lesson. Quite a man, this Talia. What did he say of me?
Please don't call me a priestess.
He told me that you would pose no threat to me.
His brow arched. Is that so? My father ordered me to kill you if I couldn't take you alive.
And yet you didn't. Why? He thought for a moment before responding.
You're the 49th, he said.
But I saw more in his look than this simple confession. At the very least, he was doubtful of his mission and curious about me. If Talia knew you would pose no threat to me, he also knew we would be together, I said.
You put too much faith in an old man.
Do I? Here we are, together. His right brow arched. Did you know Samuel of Hunter was also in pursuit? I asked.
Samuel? The son of Thomas of Hunter?
He was with me at the Oasis. Talia said he came after you.
I see.
He stared at the Elianite warriors filed behind us.
If we had seen him, he would likely be dead.
Says the man in the cage.
That would be the doing of the other son, he said. Aaron, son of Mossium, ruler of all Elianites.
He took us? I looked at the warriors behind us. He knows who I am?
He does now, and is likely reporting the claim in their courts as we speak.
Three sons of three powerful fathers, Jacob, Samuel, and now Aaron. And me. To what end? What else happened at the pass last night? I asked.
Jacob cleared his throat and told me the rest, sparing no detail. He was right. I would have been killed if not for Jacob's intervention.
How could Talia have known it would play out just so? If I ever saw him again, I would have to ask.
Your satchel, Jacob said, pulling a small leather pouch from inside his cloak. It was in the cart, and I took the liberty of keeping it safe. It appears they took all but the paper and the fruit.
I took the satchel. Talia's, not mine. You looked inside?
I was looking for something to dress your wound with. I had to settle for a strip of my own undergarment.
I set aside thoughts of his filthy clothing and untied the pouch. Inside I found a strange orange fruit and a sheet of very old paper that had been torn out of a book. Blank on both sides. The hope that lit my mind was dim, but a spark nonetheless. Talia would never have left these two items without specific intentions. Fruit. Not the rambutan that prevented me from dreaming, but another kind that held another power. What, I didn't yet know. And paper. The only thing I could think of was a page from his book of history to write on. But there was nothing to write with here.
What is it? Jacob asked.
I quickly cinched up the satchel. It's nothing.
Really? Because to me it looked like you'd just found a Rausch. When a woman says nothing, she always means something. Usually something important to her.
You saw it. It's nothing.
Fine. Nothing it is. Which means something that I know nothing about.
Fine. Something then. A piece of fruit and a piece of paper. I like to eat, and I like to write. I handed the satchel back, and he hid it under his clothing for safekeeping. Do you write?
Does Jacob write? Ask any woman in Kurangi City, and she will tell you of the honey that flows from my pen.
A poet. Jacob was nothing, if not a contradiction. And yet no more of one than I was.
It's what your captor said about torture that I would pay attention to, the man in the corner said without turning.
We both looked at him, followed his stare.
The cart had crested a small hill and was heading down a widening road into the valley below. There, in stark contrast to the rural fields we had passed, sprawled a great city. I was immediately struck by two things. The first was its immensity, not just in size, but in structure. A tall, thick wall marked its perimeter. The buildings were made of white stone, each capped with a red roof. Tall structures rose from the city center, the tallest of which was domed and topped with a towering spire. Gold. The second was the city's cleanliness and order. Every street, every building, every structure had been placed with precision, like a giant spoked wheel, with the domed thrall as its hub.
"Don't let its beauty deceive you," the old man said, turning to us. "They are butchers, eager to aid Elion by sending all heretics and heathens to an early hell. And if they believe you are the fabled 49th, I fear worse than death for you."
I looked at the man's green eyes. "An albino? But what kind? And you are?"
"Cirrus, a heretic, like you."
My pulse surged. "You're a mystic?"
"Heavens, no. No, I'm afraid I don't see the material world in the same generous light that your kind do. I see the world for what it is. Evil. At the very least, meaningless. We are Gnostics, the fifth kind, servants of Elion, who made none of what you see. Our only hope is to live in peace until we escape this world, which for us in this cart will be soon enough."
I looked past him to the city. The farms had given way to a great open expanse of grasslands that pressed up against the city walls. "What do you mean, the fifth kind?" I asked. He eyed me curiously.
"You're a mystic. Don't you know?"
"Actually, I've..."
"She was poisoned by our high priest and has lost her memory," Jacob said. "When you say fifth kind, you mean races of human, no?"
"If you will. There are Horde, the diseased ones. There are albinos, who have been cleansed in the Red Lakes. And there are Leiden, Chitaiki, who have crossbred with Horde. Three races."
"Leiden." My mind skipped to Vlad Smith, and I wondered if he was half Chitaiki.
"Three races," Jacob said. "And yet you say there are five kinds."
"Because among the albino race there are three sects. Elionite, Gnostic, and Mystic. I am of the Gnostics."
"You're forgetting the circle," I said.
"The who?" the Gnostic asked.
Jacob answered for me.
"Albinos on the far side. A few thousand at most, led by Thomas of Hunter."
"Never heard of them," the Gnostic said.
"And who are you, Rochelle? In Christi. What is known that cannot be named?"
"Me," I thought. "I was in Christi, but I didn't really know it. Or the second seal would be on my arm. In fact, I only had one seal. Until I had all five, Talia said, any of them were vulnerable. I carried this truth like a heavy weight." Cirrus faced the city.
"I have only met one mystic, years ago now, and I was stunned by her power. Yet here I find another who has neither knowledge nor power, only the mark on her arm."
"Did you not hear me?" Jacob snapped. "She was poisoned by a foul beast who spreads fear and death."
I marveled at Jacob's defense of me. "The Elionites," I said to the old man, "they're heretics to you. Why?"
Cirrus sighed.
What is a heretic? What is a heretic? Who is to know? The Elianites have many factions who argue over nuances of ancient scriptures, which they worship in the same way they worship the Red Lakes. They've settled on a short list of required beliefs that all must adopt or suffer damnation. Confession of these beliefs makes one an Elianite, those who claim to be the only true followers of Justin. They are materialists, and they treat the world in the same way they believe Elian treats them. They say only adherence to certain beliefs can appease Elian's wrath. Cross those beliefs at your own peril. Need I say more?
You know their ruler?
Jacob asked. Mossium. He's an old man, more concerned with maintaining his status than serving Elian. He's taken the liberty of naming the city after himself. It's the first of seven cities, the largest, but not by much.
He paused.
Next you will ask me about their army, so I will tell you. The ones who escort us now are the court guard. Elite fighters, 100,000 strong, led by Aaron, a brilliant tactician, as you so recently discovered. But the other 400,000 are nearly as proficient killers.
He faced Jacob.
I don't know the horde, but unless you have an army many times the size of theirs, I would stick to your side of the divide. The Elianites have spared no expense in amassing an army to protect their beliefs.
Jacob humphed, but left it alone. We settled into silence as the cart approached the city. The main arched gate loomed, and then we were through, into a city with cobblestone streets and manicured lawns, thick carpets of grass with brightly flowered beds. Carts rolled along the streets, carrying grain and vegetables and bricks. Swords and dark brown leathers identified the guards stationed at every corner. All turned to look as we passed, showing respect with their stillness and silence. Their respect was for the court guard. The sight of us garnered spits. I would say no fewer than 100 residents spat to the side as we passed through their city. I couldn't be sure, but I assumed this was a reaction to Jacob, and I felt myself wanting to tell him not to take it personally. Instead, I held my tongue, wondering if I was wrong. For all I knew, they were disgusted with me, the mystic. I could only imagine their reactions if they knew I was also the 49th. We passed shops and large fields with children playing organized games, something like field hockey. They had green eyes, as did all albinos. They wore clean tunics with earth-toned slacks, sandals. Many wore silver chains with red pendants, round like red pools, I thought, because Cirrus had told us they worshipped the Red Lakes. My fear began to settle. In every way, the Elianites were just people who'd carved out an idyllic life under the rule of law. Surely they would do us no harm. The city changed as we made our way to its center. Here the buildings were taller and extravagantly appointed with gold and silver trimming. Black flags with the solid red circle at the center swayed in a gentle breeze at every entrance. The city hub was clearly off-limits to all but a particular class, all dressed in white or black. At the heart stood the massive circular building with a golden dome that I'd seen from the road. We were escorted to a wide wing on its right side. One of the warriors rode up to the door, spoke briefly with a commander, then turned back and motioned to his men. The door to our cart was unlocked and thrown wide.
"You'd better be worth it," the warrior said to Jacob. "If there's no gold in this for me, I'll find you and drown you myself."
He looked at me.
"You first."
He reached in, grabbed my good leg, and dragged me out of the cart. Pain screamed up my side
and I felt the world start to fade. Jacob was scolding the man, and somewhere someone was shouting, but my mind was in a dense fog. I felt myself thrown over a shoulder, felt the jostling as they carried me, heard keys rattling, gates opening and closing, felt mind-numbing pain when they dumped me on the ground.
"Barbarians!"
Jacob shouted. I cried out as he handled my leg.
"Not that."
"Not what? I have to straighten it."
"Whatever you're doing, not that."
"Sorry, sorry, but I have to do something." They'd thrown us in a small cell, maybe 4 paces per side. The floor was made of stone, and the walls were fashioned with iron bars. There was no sign of the old Gnostic, but Jacob was bent over me, muttering curses. I looked down and nearly threw up. Whatever had been holding my leg together earlier had clearly given way. My body began to tremble, and I closed my eyes, desperate to find some relief.
"I have to..."
"Leave it," I snapped. "Don't touch me." He withdrew, then rushed to the barred door.
"By Tiles Fangs, can we get a physician here?"
His voice echoed down an empty corridor.
"Don't say that,"
I breathed, desperate for relief.
"We need a man of medicine. You can't rot in here like this."
"Don't invoke Tile," I said. "They won't appreciate it." But then I was moaning again, uncaring what he said. When I opened my eyes, I saw that he was pacing, fists clenched. It had never occurred to me that one such as Jacob would care so much. Of course, he was tasked with returning me to Baal, but no, it was more.
"This Talia of yours," he said, "what would he say to you now?"
"To look past the pain."
"And can you do this?"
"No."
"But you insist that he intentionally left you, which means he must have known that you would end up here, with me, as you said. So then what provision would he offer for such a time of need? An incantation of some kind, a hex?"
"He's not that kind of mystic." He withdrew Talia's satchel and quickly untied it, dumped the contents out. The page floated to the floor as the orange fruit plopped down by my side. Ignoring the paper, he snatched up the fruit.
"There are rumors the albinos under Thomas of Hunter use fruit to heal. Do you know what this fruit is?"
Even as he said it, the fog in my mind began to clear. "The fruit." "It's not my satchel," I said.
"The wizard's satchel?"
He stared at the orange fruit in his hand.
"What do you do with it?
Eat it?" He dropped to his knees and gently lifted my head, held the fruit to my lips.
"Bite."
I bit deeply. A cool, bitter juice filled my mouth. I chewed on the flesh between my teeth and swallowed.
"Anything?"
I don't know. Maybe it takes time." Jacob raised the fruit to his lips and took a bite. Chewed. Spit out the juice. "It's bitter."
"A seed, not a fruit."
"Whatever it is, he left it for me. Try the wound." He looked at my leg, then at the fruit in his hand. A calm began to settle over me as an ancient knowledge of ways long forgotten edged into my instinctive mind.
"Take the wrapping off,"
I breathed, eyes closed. I felt his hands on my thigh, unwrapping the bandage he'd applied before my waking.
"Straighten my leg." "Are you sure?"
"Straighten it." He maneuvered my leg, and I lay still, trying to think beyond the agonizing pain, clinging to consciousness as best I could.
"It's the best I can."
"Squeeze the juice into the wound." I wasn't watching, but I felt it. felt the first drop of the fruit's juice make contact with my raw flesh, felt the tingle erupt there, in the deepest part of my nerves. A soothing heat spread through my bones. Jacob cried out and jumped back. The pain was the first to go, replaced by a healing pleasure that rode up my spine and caressed my mind. I could feel my flesh moving, hear my bones popping and scraping as they shifted back into alignment and fused together. But mostly I felt the warmth of being held by a power far greater than my body. I felt myself being pulled into an endless light, and I trembled with relief and gratitude. And then I was gone, swept away in a blissful sleep that plucked me out of that cell, held me in a warm, tender embrace for an eternity, then set me gently down in another cell. The cell in which I was asleep under the streets of Eden, Utah, 2,000 years earlier. Chapter 22. Hillary Moses woke from the nightmare in a cold sweat. She'd kicked the covers off the bed in the night, but her skin was clammy and her shirt soaked. Something was wrong. Terribly, terribly wrong. She knew that, like she knew she'd slept late. Late. And if Simon knew, he'd have a word or two to say about it. Simon. Her memories erupted like a volcano, and she jerked up in bed. The scene had been seared into her mind in vivid detail. All of it. She'd awakened in the middle of the night to get a drink. Not last night, but the night before that. Simon was either in his chambers at the courthouse or sleeping in the master bedroom where he always slept. She'd been given the fourth bedroom because he didn't want to sleep with her, and that was fine with her. The less she saw of him, the better. Her hatred of him was so ancient, she'd long ago forgotten why she'd ever fallen in love with him in the first place. Simon, the one who lorded over her with an iron fist. Simon, the taskmaster who forbade her from making eye contact with any other man. Simon, the monster who beat her black and blue and then had the gall to tell the others that she'd fallen down the stairs. How many times could a woman fall down the stairs, anyway? She'd always hated him. The whole town knew she hated him. But still she found the strength to be a good wife. Eden depended on her. Humanity's survival required a few sacrifices, and she'd accepted her role as one of those willing to make them. Simon was too important to betray. That had all changed 2 nights ago, when Hillary heard the sound of soft laughter on her way to get a glass of water. A woman's laughter. She'd stopped in the hallway and listened. There it was again, coming from the master bedroom. Stunned, she'd stepped to the door and put her hand on the knob, refusing to consider, much less believe, what a woman's laughter in her husband's room could mean. The sound had to be in her mind. Which made sense, because her heart had leaped in her chest the moment she'd first seen Vlad Smith in the auditorium. The way he'd looked at her. The way he put Simon in his place. The way he whispered in her ear. She was hearing the sounds of a woman in Simon's room because she felt guilty for having those thoughts about Vlad. So she opened the door, expecting nothing but a dark room. The sight that greeted her didn't register at first. 2 candles lit. Her husband, fully dressed by the window, glass of scotch in his right hand. His other hand was behind a woman's neck, holding her close. It was Linda Loving, the council member. Their lips were locked in a tender kiss. It was the way they were doing it, so comfortably, like a hand familiar with a well-worn glove.
that told Hillary the true story. Simon and Linda's affair was as ancient as Hillary's hatred. They both noticed her at the same time.
"What are you doing up?"
Simon demanded. "I'm..."
She was in too much shock to put her words in order.
I'm,
he mocked. "Get back to bed before I beat you deaf and dump you there myself."
She retreated and shut the door, heart crashing into her throat. The rage came then, like a dragon breathing fire, years of hatred and abuse breaking through, demanding justice. Hillary hadn't been able to fall back asleep after seeing what she'd seen. So she'd gotten up in the pre-dawn, dressed, and headed out. To nowhere or anywhere. Then to the hydroelectric plant north of town, thinking she should blow the thing sky high, just like Vlad had threatened to do. But no, that would be too risky. Simon would kill her. Truth was, if she did anything at all that compromised him, he would probably kill her, if for no other reason than to keep his secret a secret. She'd returned to the house late that morning to find Peter in a frantic mess. He told her about the shooting in the sanctuary. Barth had shot Rochelle in the leg, and they'd locked her in the cellar.
"Why?"
"Something to do with Vlad," he said. "Something Dad thinks could compromise Eden, but I don't get it." Neither did Hillary, and at the time she didn't really care. She had her own problems. She retired to her room, where she'd spent the rest of the day pacing. Simon didn't come home. He was too busy either sucking up to Linda or hunting Vlad. Now, memories swirling, Hillary threw off the soaked sheet and hurried to the window. The day was overcast. The house was dead quiet. The only course of action that made any sense to her dropped into her mind then. Vlad. He would know what to do. She had to find Vlad. And now she knew how. Rochelle. For all she knew, she was already too late. She had to hurry. It took her only a few minutes to throw some clothes on, grab the spare keys, and set her resolve to do this quickly, before anybody knew what was happening. She thought about brushing her teeth and combing her hair, decided not to. The sky was dark when she stepped outside, way too dark for 10 in the morning. A quick scan of the streets, and she saw no one. They were all locked down in their homes under the guise of this martial law nonsense. Someone needed to shove that law down Simon's throat. Hillary walked quickly, head down, straight for the back of the courthouse, church, palace, for Simon. She'd missed a button, and her shirt was crooked. Maybe best to fix that before anyone noticed. But no one was going to notice, because she had no intention of being seen. She stopped 10 feet from the back door, noting the cars along First Street for the first time. Dozens of them. The town was in assembly. At 10 in the morning? Images of a full sanctuary skipped through her mind. What if they were putting Rochelle on trial? Why else would they be meeting? Regardless, this was a good thing. It meant everyone would be in the main auditorium. The way to the cellar was down 2 flights of stairs at the back, to the right of Hillary's office. She hurried up the steps and opened the back door with a quiver in her hand, eased inside. No light. The backup battery bank had enough juice to light the sanctuary, but without electricity to recharge them, they'd be dead in a day or two. Hillary listened for any sound. Nothing. 4 walls between her back office and the auditorium. Barely breathing, she grabbed a flashlight off the counter, eased into the side hall, entered the stairwell,
and ran down the steps into the basement, called the cellar, to distinguish it from any ordinary basement. Other than her, no one outside the council and the security team even knew it existed. She found Rochelle in the first cell, curled up on the floor beyond the white steel bars, sleeping. Relief washed over her. Still here. Thank God. With one last glance down the hall, she fumbled with the keys, tried three before landing on the one that opened the lock, and stepped into the cell. She played the beam of light over Rochelle's body, saw all the blood around a single hole in her jeans, 4 inches above her knee, and more blood on her right sleeve. Peter had said something about that. No wound, he'd said. But none of that was Hillary's concern. Rochelle? She pushed on the girl's arm. Wake up! I woke with a gasp. Jacob? It's me, Hillary. Thank God you're alive. Hillary? Where was I? The light moved, and I saw that it was from a flashlight.
Eden.
Hillary came into view, bent over me. She'd missed a button on her shirt, and sweat plastered her stringy hair to her forehead and cheeks. But it was her frantic eyes that alarmed me. What's wrong? I asked. She was answering, but my mind was on my predicament. I was back in the cellar. From one person to another, I'd been shot and woken in my dreams with the wound, then healed when Jacob squeezed the fruit into my wound. I looked down at my leg, moved it, then gingerly touched my thigh. No pain. I touched the hole in my jeans and felt my skin. Crusted blood, but no wound. "Are you listening to me?" Hillary demanded. Her eyes skipped to my leg. What is it? Whatever happened to my body in one dream also happened in the other dream. Present Earth and future Earth. I clambered to my feet and stared down at my leg. Hillary looked befuddled.
I thought you were shot.
I was.
So what happened?
Same thing that happened to my eyes. Close enough, I thought.
Vlad?
No, not Vlad. Definitely not Vlad. Hillary grabbed my arm. She glanced over her shoulder and whispered,
You have to tell me how to find him. They're up there right now. And if he's not with them, that's a problem. So I gotta find him.
Slow down. I registered her panic. No more than I might notice a hand gently tugging on my shirt. Half of me was still swooning from the events in the Elyonite City.
Take a deep breath. Who's up there right now? What's happening? The whole town. I can't take it anymore.
She was grabbing her hair with her free hand.
Not a single second.
What had happened to her? What had transformed Hillary Moses from calm to crazed? The town was falling apart. My father, they'd taken him to a shed. That tug of fear was no longer gentle.
Okay, just take another breath.
I had to find my father.
They took my father to a shed. Do you know where that is?
She absently shook her head, pacing now.
You hear anything about him?
Another shake. I breathed a prayer, hoping Barth hadn't continued to beat him.
What time is it? After 10.
She stopped pacing and faced me, eyes wild.
He beats me, Rochelle. He beats me, and he's sleeping with that slut on the council. I can't stand by anymore. I just can't.
Beating her? Was it possible?
And an affair?
I'd always thought of both Simon and Linda as loyal to the bone.
Which is why you have to tell Vlad that I need him, Hillary begged, reaching for me. You know how to get to him, right? He healed you. You're special to him, right? I don't know what else to do. Please.
She thought Vlad could help her.
You don't understand. Vlad's not who you think he is. And these things you're talking about can't be.
Don't tell me what can and can't be, she cried, recoiling. She shoved a finger at the wall.
I walked in on him. I saw it with my own two eyes. You have the nerve to tell me that each time he beat me these past 10 years can't be what it was? You think it's all, what, in my mind? How dare you?
I'm not saying that. I just think,
I don't care what you think,
she snapped, stomping one foot.
You tell me how to find Vlad, you hear me? Or I'm gonna burn this whole town to the ground.
I took a step back. There would be no reasoning with her in this state of mind. Part of me thought I should run out and lock her in the cell until she cooled down and I could figure out what was going on. The seal on my shoulder reminded me that there was more to the world than what we saw as problems.
In this world, you will have trouble, but have no fear. I have overcome.
Yeshua. That could only be good news if we too could overcome with him.
In the world, but not of it. That state of being beyond polarity was far more powerful than any of us could possibly know in these earthen vessels. I had to find the second seal.
What is known that cannot be named?
I took a calming breath and spoke as evenly as I could.
You say they're meeting upstairs right now?
I think so, yes.
Then that's the first place to look for him.
But he'll be there.
Who? The judge?
Don't call him that,
she snapped. Simon, I corrected. She clearly felt judged and wanted no more of it.
If Simon brought the town together, it's because of him.
Vlad.
Yes, Vlad.
So what do we do?
We go up there.
Now?
Right now.
I don't know if I can take seeing that pig.
The shift in Hillary's demeanor was so radical that I wondered who'd stolen her mind. Planks of judgment and grievance blinded the world, yes, but this, she was hardly the same person. What was Simon hiding in that room of his?
I'll be with you, I said. You can't hide forever. One way or the other, we'll get to the bottom of this, I promise.
I'm already at the bottom of it, as low as any woman can go.
Which is why I'm going with you.
I stepped up and took her free hand.
I'll be right there with you, okay?
Hillary considered my suggestion for a second, then nodded.
Okay. Okay, good. Just stay close to me. Promise?
Another nod. I led her from the cell, down the hall, and into the stairwell. I used echolocation to guide my way up the metal steps because she had the flashlight trained on her feet, 2 steps behind me. By the time we reached the side door leading into the sanctuary, I'd all but let go of my concern for Hillary. My thoughts had returned to the seals, and to my father, and to Vlad, and to finding out what was wrong in Eden. I could hear Hillary's heavy breathing right behind me as I paused at the door and listened.
Can you hear him?
Simon's voice spoke over a cacophony of voices, urging calm. Whatever had happened, he was losing control. I pushed the door open and stepped into the sanctuary. We were on the east side of the room, to the right of the platform, which was obstructed by the long velvet curtains that hung ceiling to floor on either side of the stage. I couldn't see who was on stage. What I could see were the other residents. Cindy and Bill. Jarvis, the gardener. William Braxton,
and his wife closest to me, eyes glued on the stage. All of them. Half were on their feet and in the aisles, a far cry from the order typically required of Eden's gatherings. A full third of them were talking at once. "I don't care what the law is," Cindy was saying. "As far as I'm concerned, until you find Eden's children, there are no laws. And if you think you can just shoot me like you shot Miranda, be my guest." A chill washed down my back. The children? Marcella? Frankie? I could see 7 or 8 younger children from my vantage point. How many were missing? The room erupted, and Simon slammed his gavel down on the block. "Order! For the sake of all that is lawful and godly, order! What good is the law if it can't protect our children?" Someone shouted.
"We called you here to organize a search."
Linda Loving was begging for reason, but her voice was filled with fear.
"We can sort out how this happened as soon as we find them. Don't you think I know how you feel? Jordan and Holly are..."
She burst into tears. The calm lasted only a few seconds. "So what are we waiting for?" Bill Baxter said from across the auditorium. "I agree with Cindy. We all have a right to search." "When are you going to get this through your thick skulls?" Barth boomed from the stage. "There's a predator out there. We can't have all of you running through the woods going berserk. Only hand-picked members I know I can trust." He tried to say more, but his voice was drowned out by another outburst. And that outburst was silenced by the loud crack of his gun, fired into the ceiling. I could hear the drywall rain down in the silence following his gunshot. He slapped his gun down on the bench. "Order means order. You see the gun. One more of you gets out of order, and I swear, I put a bullet through your head. Understood?" I walked into full view then. Sue, seated next to R.G., was the first to see me, and her eyes went wide. Then Peter, who glanced at my leg and blinked. Karina, Hillary's 7-year-old daughter, wasn't in the pew next to him. She was among the missing children? Hillary stepped out with me, eyes fixed on the stage. 2, and then a dozen, and then all of them turned to look in our direction. The sight of me with bloodied shirt and jeans, and Hillary with scrambled hair and crooked shirt, held them in silence. I was watching Barth, whose face had gone white.
"How'd you get out of the prison?"
"I let her out," Hillary said. "Vlad healed her leg."
Barth reached for his gun, but Simon stopped him.
"Leave it, Barth. Just calm down. Everyone, just stay calm."
"What prison?"
someone asked. Then another.
"Who shot you?"
The room was a powder keg. Vlad was having his way. They had to understand that I wasn't their enemy. The council was. Vlad was. The whole system was. I walked across the front, speaking with as strong a voice as I could gather. "It doesn't matter what prison or who shot me, but I can see, can't I? My eyes are healed and my leg is healed, so maybe I'm someone you should listen to." I could practically see the wheels spinning behind their eyes. "How many children are missing?"
7,
someone said.
"Okay, 7.
I knew there was no way to find them quickly, not if this was Vlad's doing. I would be the key, and the thought of that nauseated me.
"And how many of us here? 150? The valley is roughly 2 square miles, right?"
"About that," Bill said, nodding at me.
"Frank, Luke," Barth barked, "grab her by the collar and take her down."
I turned to the stage,
with the intent of discouraging both Frank and Luke from following his orders, but the sight of Hillary stopped me cold. Barth's